Good evening, good morning, wherever you're listening from. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host for the evening, Dave Schrader. Thank you for joining me. Tonight, we've got a great show lined up for you. In the first half, psychiatrist Steven Seeger will join me to share his true insider's account of working in a hospital for the criminally insane, a facility that houses real-life Hannibal Lecters. We're also going to take a different look at the JFK assassination. Not from a historian, not from a librarian who's collected stories that have been spread around and told time and time again, but we're going to hear a unique perspective from a woman who is a part of the story. Judith Vary Baker, the lover of Lee Harvey Oswald, will join us tonight on Coast to Coast AM to discuss her involvement, her knowledge, and her understanding of Lee Harvey Oswald's influence in the JFK assassination, and we'll talk about her new book on David Ferry. That's all coming up a little later. Let me start off real quickly. I have a great opportunity by hosting our show, Darkness Radio, and stopping in and spending some time with Coast to Coast to get to travel the world. I get to see amazing places, meet amazing people, and I'm always happy to look at people's paranormal photographs or listen to their EVP or hear their stories. And I can't even tell you how many times I've had to look at pictures of dust balls that people believe are ghosts and, you know, what they call orbs, something I'm just not a big fan of. Then you get the rare occasion where something pops up that just knocks your socks off. And a few weeks ago, I was in Cripple Creek, Colorado, with Bill Chappell, the engineer who creates so many different tools for exploring and experimenting in the field of the paranormal. And a friend of mine, Jamie Windicker, came to visit. And just in passing, she said, oh, I saved a picture I wanted to show you. This is kind of interesting. I know it's just matrixing or pareidolia, and it's just cigarette smoke or smoke from the fire at the campsite. But I wanted to show you because I thought it was pretty creepy. The picture she presented to me was absolutely astounding. So she agreed to let us share this with you, the Coast to Coast audience. We've put the pictures up on our site, so go to coasttocoastam.com. That's coasttocoastam.com. Check out the pictures there. And joining me right now, Jamie is calling in all the way from Colorado. Jamie, thank you for joining us this evening.
Yeah, no problem. How are you tonight?
We are doing great, and I appreciate you giving me a few minutes. Now, you were in Lost Lake, Colorado, and what was this, just like a gathering of friends hanging out and having a campfire and doing a little overnight camping?
Yeah, I got invited at the end of August to go camping with some family and friends, and, you know, it was the last night there, and Lost Park or Lost Lake or Lost Creek, whatever you want to call it, goes by all the names, is kind of like in the middle of this valley, in the middle of nowhere. It's not even a campground. It's just a nice little gem for local Coloradoans to go and visit and have some fun. And we were all sitting there around the campfire having a good time. And, you know, we decided to take a couple pictures. And I'm taking pictures of my family and friends. And I take this one photo. And almost as soon as I took it, my jaw hit the floor. Because there's clearly something there. But, of course, I don't get pictures like that. So, like you said, I dismissed it as being cigarette smoke or something of those lines.
Which, to me, is amazing in itself, Jamie, because everybody shows me pictures that they claim are paranormal and there's nothing there. Yours is the very first one I've ever had where somebody showed me a picture and said, oh, I know this is nothing, but I thought it was kind of cool anyway. I wanted to show it to you. This is one of the most astounding pictures. Now, the problem for listeners out there, before they jump on this too quickly, the problem with photographs, especially with cell phones now, is there are applications. One is called Ghost Capture, Ghost on Film, a couple of different things like that, that you can actually apply a pre-done ghosty image into one of your photographs, and you can actually change how visual it is, how opaque, how ghosty it looks, where you can place it in the photograph. And there's I think about 60 or 70 different images to choose from. So when you showed me this picture, I forwarded it to a few of my friends that are big into that and know all of the different pictures to look at and expose. They were all blown away. One of the things that pointed out to me was the fact that the picture's a little blurry because you're taking it with a cell phone in low light setting at night, and the images of some of the people are very blurry. And when you expose and enlarge this image, the ghost-like image is blurry as well, as though it was part of the actual moment in that low light setting. Whereas if you add the ghost in a phone application, the ghost will be very clear and concise. This is just as crazy blurry as everything else in the picture, but the imagery is something unlike anything I've ever seen before. And
it's really creepy looking.
Yeah, it is. Now, this looks like, and it's Colorado, and there's quite a few different Native American cultures that were in that area. So what I wanted to do, and Jamie was kind enough to agree to come on the show and talk to us about this, I wanted to make this available. So if anybody out there knows about the Native American culture, I mean, to me, it looks like some kind of voodoo priestess or perhaps a shaman, some kind of veil over their face. But it looks as though they're wearing like white makeup on and very ornate. It is so detailed. You can see eyes, nose, mouth, ears. And this isn't just a case of pareidolia. The detailing on it is astounding. And when you enlarge it, instead of it breaking up and pixelating, it actually gets clear. And it looks remarkable for what you're seeing here. So what we'd like to do, you can email me at dave@darknessradio.com. Again, that's dave@darknessradio.com. If you have any idea what this image is that's making itself known. Now, you could not see this with the naked eye. I know that the one boy almost seems to be looking up at it, and there's a girl with a ponytail looking towards the guy that's looking up at it. They're not seeing anything there, correct?
No, they didn't see anything at all. And, you know, of course, if I had been smart, I would have taken a picture right afterwards to see if I got anything else. But, you know, that didn't happen.
Right. It's just one of those moments. Now, again, you just kind of, the positioning of it almost looked like it was cigarette smoke coming off of your friend's cigarette who's in the foreground.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was at first.
Right. But we explored the picture, and actually what looks kind of like a trail of cigarette smoke is actually the back of one of the people's chair. And then this thing is superimposed out and in front, almost like it's gazing at the fire as well. And what I thought was intriguing is the face has lit features as though it is being lit up by the fire the same way everybody else is, because the boy that's sitting in the chair, his half of his face is away from the fire, and the other side that's there, you can see that reddish glow. You can see that reddish glow on the front of the face of this being, and it is truly one of the more astounding paranormal style photographs I've ever seen. So if somebody out there has any insight on this, shoot us an email. Let me know what you think it is. Have you had a chance to do any more research about this or have anybody look at it from that area?
Yes and no. I poked around a little bit, and the only thing that I could find about Lost Park was at one point in time, it was one of the largest getaways, if you will, for a very huge buffalo herd. And what do you associate buffaloes with? Of course, you know, Native Americans. I couldn't find a specific tribe that would have been there, but close to Lost Park is actually Cripple Creek, like very, very close. And from what I'm understanding, the biggest tribe there were the Utes, so possibly they could have been part of that.
It is. It's astounding, folks. Go check it out for yourself. CoastToCoastAM.com. It's right there on the front page. You can see the photograph, and if you click on it, you'll see the original photograph she sent me, the enlarged version of it, and then one where I lightened it up to try to get some more detail. So take a look at it for yourself. Check it out. Jamie, thank you so much for sharing this. And as people pour in with for information and answers on this, I will share that with you. And we'll also share it with the Coast to Coast audience. If anybody gets any insights or information, I'll make sure that we get that sent over to the website and keep it updated. But thank you again for sharing your image with us, Jamie.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I can't wait to hear what other people think of it.
Yeah, I can't wait either. This is something really exciting when it comes to the paranormal field with photographs. Jamie is somebody I know and have known for many years. She is not an attention seeker when it comes to the paranormal. She's usually very quiet and just likes to observe. That's why this photograph specifically was so interesting to me. She downplayed the importance of it. She downplayed what she believed. She was trying to convince me it was cigarette or perhaps campfire smoke. I see something definitely in this photograph that is not smoke, and I don't believe it's just some kind of pixelated imagery. So if you've got any insights, shoot us an email, dave@darknessradio.com. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going behind the gates of Gomorrah, a year with the criminally insane, in a story more terrifying than I think any demonic encounter or ghostly story we've shared in the past. Stay tuned. That happens next on Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. We've got an interesting show lined up for you. Right now, we're going to go behind the gates of Gomorrah, looking at a brand new book called A Year with the Criminally Insane. Steven Seeger is our guest this evening. Psychiatrist Steven Seeger was no stranger to locked psych wards when he accepted a job at California's Gorman State Hospital, known locally as Gomorrah. But nothing could have prepared him for what he encountered when he stepped through its gates. Let's welcome Steven Seeger to the show. Steven, this is a story that, as it unfolds more for me and is reading through the book, and we've heard for years of patients that have been mistreated in insane asylums or in mental facilities, and we've seen photographs of the way that some of these hospitals were treated, and definitely understaffed hospitals where one nurse was responsible for 20 to 30 patients and patients sitting in their own feces, and you hear about these horrific conditions. Your story is terrifying about the humanity of it from a totally different perspective. The heroic nature of the people that work behind the gates of this hospital is what struck me. And I thought it's important for the listeners of Coast to Coast around the world to know about this, that in the year 2014, we're not talking the 40s, the 50s, maybe even the 60s, where there wasn't more knowledge about it. We're talking 2014. This is truly one of the most abhorrent stories to come out, and you're a part of this. Talk to us a little bit about this hospital and how you came to work at it, and then we'll start to unfold what we find behind these doors as the show progresses.
Thanks, Dave. It's a really pleasure. I know we've spoken earlier. It's a pleasure to be back. I wanted to clear something up. I work at Napa State Hospital in California. The Gorman was an initial attempt to try and hide the identity of the hospital, and I realized that's just stupid. They know I work at Napa. But what's interesting about this hospital is you hit the nail right on the head. The perception is that the patients are mistreated by the staff and that they're these horrible, awful places. But they've morphed into something really unusual, which is the patients now are referred from the court. All of them, 90%, are criminals as well as being mentally ill. And they're beating up on each other and on the staff. We have, at our hospital, 3,000 assaults a year. Mainly on the patients, but a lot on the staff. We've had doctors. Every doctor I've worked with has been assaulted. We've had nurses, but it's the patients, and they'll admit to 3,000 a year. Imagine that's 10 a day. Imagine if at your radio station or wherever you work, they had 10 assaults a day, serious assaults, broken bones, broken legs, broken faces. What would happen? Wouldn't the government respond, or wouldn't something happen? But apparently nothing happens because we have them behind that fence. We have 10 a day.
This hospital has some of the most bizarre, some of the most violent and vicious criminals. Why are they not in isolation? I mean, you hear about these stories, you think of things like the Arkham Asylum from the Batman movies, where you've got all of these insane people, even thinking of Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, how everybody is behind these plexiglass walls and kept away. But you're saying that these criminals are allowed to just intermingle in the populace, and there's no security between you and the criminals that are populating this facility.
You're exactly right. And that's what struck me. I was dumbfounded when I first worked there, because no one tells you this, is that it's, imagine, you know, in the movie Silence of the Lambs, Hannibal Lecter's in a cage or whatever. These guys just walk down the halls with us. I bump knuckles with these guys. You know, we watch football games. You develop relationships, but it's the worst 1,200 people in Northern California. And it's not just my hospital. There are probably 200 of these hospitals across the country. There are hospitals in Minnesota. There's hospitals in New York. There's hospitals in Texas. There's hospitals in Maryland. And they all have exactly the same problems. I've been accumulating this huge archive of data. And every single state hospital has these exact same problems. The staff is just getting the hell beat out of them, as well as the patients are beating the heck out of each other. Imagine you go to the hospital and you're trying to get well, and you want to get well and go home, but you keep getting, punched in the face or broken arms. We just have this ridiculous sort of thing, and it's so crazy. Since I've spoken to you first, I had an op-ed piece in the New York Times on November 11th, and everyone keeps saying to me, that can't be true. Even when it's in the New York Times and fact-checked, it can't be true. But it is true. It's exactly like that. It's just absolute horrible chaos. I have emails documenting all this stuff, and I'm there every day. I was there, the day before Thanksgiving, and we had a couple people get punched in the face that day.
Walk me through this for you. Tell me about your practice and where you came from before you went behind the walls of Gomorrah here.
Well, I came from a pretty rock and roll. I was an emergency room physician at the trauma center for 11 years. I've seen a lot of stuff. I was an inpatient psychiatrist, at a big regional hospital in Utah. I've been a child psychiatrist, had an office. And I've seen emergencies and I've seen stuff, but they don't tell you what's going on there. They don't even tell people who work there. I went through orientation and they gave me this beeper, and a guy actually said, I said, what do I do with this? And he says, push that red button and maybe somebody will come before they kill you. That was the very first day I worked there. And so it's this total surprise, and everybody there just kind of keeps very
quiet. Wait a minute, Stephen. Yeah, push the red button. Maybe somebody will get there before they kill you?
That's an honest quote. Yeah, that was the very first thing someone said as I walked in the door. It was in the book, but the editors kept taking it out because as bad as the book is, and you've read it, you know it's bad.
Right.
It also has, it's humane and it's funny, and I think it's a good book, but it tells some bad stories. I actually had to tone it down because I sold it to Simon & Schuster, but originally some other publishers had wanted to buy it, but they accused me of over-sensationalizing it. So I said, no, that's not true. But so I actually toned the manuscript down. It is actually worse than it is in the book. And
they thought that you were over-sensationalizing it. Did they realize you're putting your career and your future on the line for a book that you'll get paid once for and maybe a couple of residual checks for an entire career that could get you out of it because of revealing this?
What would be my motive for doing that? But my real motive, I decided, the real truth is, these people are my patients, and they're getting the hell beat out of them on a regular basis, and they can't get better. Some of them die in the hospital from the beatings they take. They need a voice. My nurses need a voice. The staff needs a voice. Nothing was getting out. People can't get in. We had the BBC try and get in. We had New York Times try and get in. The Today Show. We had everybody try and get in, and they just were stonewalled. You can't get any information in or out of there. And so I thought, I'm going to bring some information out, and I'm going to let the chips fall where they may. And so I took a fair chance. Nothing has happened so far. But had I quit, people always ask me, why do you go back? And the reason I go back is because they need a voice that's there. Had I quit, people would just said, oh, he's a disgruntled employee. That's all just made up. But I'm there, and they can't challenge me. They can't say it's safe. They can't say I'm wrong because I'm not.
You go to work at this hospital with the idea that you want to help, you want to make a difference and help maybe rehabilitate some of these people, get into the mind of some of them so you understand how to deal with other psychopaths, sociopaths, murderers, villains, things along that nature. And you realize that the veil separating you from safety is paper thin and
relatively non-existent.
Right. How is this possible that there is not a major security force on deck for a hospital that houses, did you say over 3,000 violent criminals?
1,200 patients.
Oh, 1,200,
exactly.
Okay.
It's so difficult to get information, I can't even tell you. They won't even release, they don't have a number of patients. It's either 1,150 or 1,207. They're so paranoid about information, they won't even say how many beds we have. But in answer to your question, I go there because I'm a physician, they're my patients, and they get better. If I can keep them from getting beat up, a lot of my patients get better and eventually leave the hospital to either go home or go back and face the charges and get involved with the court system and go back as sane. So it's why we don't have guards, I can't answer you. We ask, every single person in the hospital asks, and we just don't. We have the largest police force in the hospital, in the county, but they're outside. They're like, when I go to book signings, I say, here's what you imagine. Imagine there's a cop 400 yards away, and the largest man you've ever seen suddenly starts to beat the living hell out of you. Well, how much can he beat on you before someone can run 400 yards? And so there are cops around, but it takes 2, 3, 4 minutes, and it really doesn't help. There's simply no one on the unit. There's just the staff, the patients, the door's locked, and we're in there alone.
We've all heard the old saying, the inmates are taking over the asylum. Our guest this evening, Dr. Steven Seeger, we're going to talk to him more about his book, Behind the Gates of Gomorrah, talk more about this unbelievable situation that he finds himself in on a daily basis. He, the other doctors and nurses, putting their own lives in the line of safety in order to try to help. Will this work? Can there be rehabilitation when there is this kind of anarchy? We'll talk more about that right after this. Good evening and welcome back to the show. Behind the Gates of Gomorrah, a year with the criminally insane. That's our guest Steven Seeger's topic here for the first 2 hours of this evening's show. A little later, Judith Very Baker will join us to discuss her books, Me and Lee, about her life, love, and losing Lee Harvey Oswald. We'll also hear about her unique perspective on the JFK assassination. She has some startling things to share with us this evening, and we'll talk about her new book with David Ferry. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader, and if you enjoy the strange and the supernatural, you can join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight Central. Just go to darknessradio.com. You can stream our show right from there, or if you're in the Minneapolis Twin Cities area, our local station is Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. And the best thing to do is right after our show ends, keep your dial right there or continue streaming, because as soon as Darkness Radio ends, then you can listen to George Norrie and Coast to Coast AM as they continue your journey into the strange and supernatural. When we return, Dr. Steven Seeger will take us behind the gates of Gomorrah and talk to us about this unbelievable story. The 1,200 to 1,500 criminally insane inmates, where there are really no security between the staff and the inmates, the violence that goes on in 2014, and how can these people possibly hope to be rehabilitated in this kind of pressure cooker? We'll find out from Steven Seeger right after this. Imagine wanting to help, adding yourself into the world of medical profession with the idea of making a difference, serving mankind, one of the most noble and lovable, I guess, positions in the world, right? You get to go in, you get to help people, and you get to aid them in their recovery, even working with criminals. There are amazing stories of criminals that have turned their life around, of people that once they get the help that they so desperately need, their life turns around. Imagine putting yourself in a position where you feel like you're going to help, and once you get into the gates, once you put yourself in here, you realize that you have added yourself to a pressure cooker that could blow at any moment. Although they've got a high amount of security, as Dr. Steven Seeger has told us, they're mostly outside the gates of Gomorrah. They're not there internally to help. How do you go about rehabilitating people that are living in a constant state of fear and a constant state of pressure, where at any time this could just literally explode and become a rage and a giant fury of violence?
Well, it's interesting. That's a very good point. For the staff, I know what I do. I watch every step I take, and I don't compare myself to anyone other than what I do, but it's sort of like being in the military, I think, in a combat zone, where if a sound you hear may be the last sound that you hear. And so I'm very careful about where I go. I can leave. I can drive away. I'm not asking for sympathy for me. The problem is my patients. They're locked inside. How do they do it? I haven't any idea. Some of them take to their room and they don't come out. Every time they come out, they get beat up. I mean, you just imagine if every time you walked out of your bedroom, someone beat you up. And we have fights in the cafeteria. We have fights all over. I have sent to me, which I'll detail later if you wish. I got sent clandestine emails for 3 days last March. I know I wasn't supposed to get them, but I did. And it details 29 assaults that took place over 3 days. And those are just random 3 days. So how they do it, I don't know. They take their medicines. They go to therapy. They're trying to get better. And then they walking down the hall and someone just lays them out. I don't know how they do it. How my female nurses do it, a lot of them, about half of them are off on disability. So So we always have people coming and going, people getting hit and leaving. I mean, I know why I stay. I've asked other doctors who've been assaulted why they come back, and they just kind of get quiet. It's a personal decision for everybody. I know why I'm there, but I can't speak for anybody else.
But trying to give somebody the help that they need and help them to develop beyond violence and getting through this. I mean, when you're trying to get yourself clear of this as a criminal, as somebody that's dealing with this mental condition of violence and rage, I mean, is there really any chance, doctor, that these people can be rehabilitated when at any moment they could be the victim?
Well,
and somebody could jump them?
Yeah, it's interesting. That's exactly how it is. Yeah, about 60% of our patients get better. Some don't. Some are there for a seriously long time. But a lot get better. But a lot of callers from these shows, I'll talk to them. They'll say, you know, my dad or my brother was sent there, and he was doing fine, and then he got hit in the head, and then he fell down, and he had to go to the hospital, and he never was quite the same, and then he died. And why, you know, I don't know why things are like that. They just are. But that's why I wrote the book. In other words, I didn't have to write the book. I just said, this is an insane place, and it's an insane situation that these poor people are put in. And they're not naturally a sort of a sympathetic group, you know, psychotic criminals. But bottom line, they deserve to be treated well. They deserve not to be beaten up all the time. And they need a voice, and my nurses need a voice, and that's what I tried to do. So whatever anybody's reasons are, these places exist. They're behind these big fences. And people, once they hear about them, somehow just go, that can't be true. Even when the New York Times came out, and we did a C-SPAN 90-minute show, and everybody in the audience said, that can't be true. And I'm just trying to tell you it is true. And it's like hearing about something that's going on, at least in Napa, it's the wine capital of the world. They have 5-star restaurants. And if you listen real carefully at some of these restaurants, you hear those assault sirens going off. I mean, it's just this crazy thing that no one has really brought to anybody's attention before. So I thought, I'm going to do it, and it's what I have to do.
You're exposing a major hiccup in the system. How is it that you haven't lost your job already, doctor?
Well, it was put to me in an interesting way. They said, what are they going to say? It is safe? I mean, really, what is their reply? It simply isn't safe. I got an interesting response from Washington when I had the New York Times piece. I was contacted by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and their head person emailed me and said, oh, we provide safe things, and here's what we do. And I wrote back and I said, listen, if you knew there was 3,000 assaults going on in this hospital, aren't you kind of obligated to do anything, do something? And I never heard from them again. And that's sort of what happens. There's just this culture of silence, this culture of violence. On my Facebook page, I have a thing that says, stop the violence, stop the silence. The problem is the violence, but the real problem is the silence. People just simply won't believe it. And you're to your credit. You've had me on twice. And people are starting to get understand there's a movement now for mandatory outpatient treatment, so people maybe won't even have to come to our place at all to begin with, that they might not commit the crimes because they're going to get the treatment as an outpatient. So there is, I think, and I hope the book is participating in sort of a small turn in how people view mental illness and how they view the mentally ill. And the stigma of being mentally ill, I always hear, well, mentally ill people have a stigma. Well, the stigma is because they walk around the street untreated. They have, they act in a bizarre fashion. They commit crimes. They have tin foil on their heads. That's why they're stigmatized. If we could get everybody treated and well, you wouldn't know they were mentally ill.
With the levels, I mean, are there different levels of offenders that, I mean, I know in local jails, in Minnesota, I've got friends that work for law enforcement, and there are some that are such violent violators that they're only allowed out for 45 minutes a day, and then they're allowed out only by themselves with no other inmates. Why is it that small towns, you'd think that small towns would have a harder time keeping control of something like this, and here you're in a major state, and you're saying that there are hospitals like this all around the United States that are overpopulated by violent criminals.
And we know how to fix this. We can't segregate them because we run into disability rights attorneys who say, well, it's to segregate people, it would make them too lonely or too isolated. And we just can't get past this sort of thing. These kind of people are in power in Sacramento. They're in power in state capitals. We know how to. We actually know how to configure. If we could get the 15% in a separate place, the other people could probably do pretty well. But we can't. We can't. There's a pilot that's coming in California next July. They're thinking about it. They're going to take a look at segregating some people out. They're finally just, I think some information is getting through, but we know how to fix this stuff. Here's the real problem, is that this takes it to a whole other level of unbelievability. We have people remanded to us from the court for treatment for their mental illness, for which they are not going to prison for murdering or raping people. And then once they get there, they are allowed to refuse that treatment. And the court says, yeah, you can refuse it. They just walk in the door and say, screw you, I'm not taking your medicines, I'm not going to therapy, I'm not going to shower.
Say that again. I think people need to hear that because that's terrifying. So here you commit a crime, you rape somebody, you violently attack somebody, you may have even murdered somebody, so you're sent court-mandated to this facility for rehabilitation. Once the criminal enters the gates of Gomorrah, they can choose?
Yes. And the court says so. We just had a case in California that was adjudicated 3 weeks ago Friday where they said if you come and you're not guilty by reason of insanity, which means you're not guilty, your court case is over. But in exchange for you not going to jail for the rest of your life or facing the electric chair, you have to get treatment for your sickness. Oh, but by the way, if you don't want that, you don't have to have it. So they can walk in and they just say, and we have about 30% of our people who just say, screw you, I'm not doing it. And you can't make me. And they know that. And I found that a little hard to believe. And I think most people do, too, that if you, in exchange for not going to jail for your crime, you get mandated for treatment. But you can, and the courts have firmly said, you can refuse that treatment.
How is it that these people, and understand, I understand there's mental issues and mental instability. So we've found that this person is guilty because they are insane or mentally deficient, unable to deal with social settings. They're not guilty because of this.
Right.
Why then do we give them the rights to say, here you go in here, but you don't have to do anything to make yourself better?
Nothing. And the courts are firm about this. We just had a case, like I said, adjudicated 3 weeks ago, that they simply can't. There's a long involved process in which we have to prove imminent danger. We can sort of reopen the hearing, but we're starting to lose a lot of those too.
Imminent danger. Doc, they were put there.
I'm going to punch you in the face right now.
Right, but they were. The imminent danger is that they were taken off the streets because they raped, killed, and violently assaulted other people. They've been put in this facility in exchange for their freedom of prison. That is. Right there, you're saying, we're taking them out of here. There's already a precedent set that this person is violent in nature. Their rights to not be treated should be terminated at the moment that they do these crimes and are found guilty by insanity or mental, unfit. It seems
hard to believe, isn't it? It's just this. I opened the book with an Alice in Wonderland analogy, and working at this place and these places is like going down the rabbit hole. The world inside this place just doesn't follow normal rules. You can imagine if at your job there were psychotic rapists, murderers, killers, child killers walking around the halls of your radio station. Or wherever you work. I mean, it's just this weird, crazy place where they get there and then they don't have to take the treatment they were sent there for. And it's just, I found it so disconcerting. I said, I got to write a book about this. Maybe I can help somehow in changing this. But that's the reaction. You have to get over this initial, like, that can't be. Well, it just is. We have people who haven't showered in 2 years and who don't take their meds, who don't go to groups, who just sit in the room. Or then they punch somebody.
So here they are living in environment where they don't take care of themselves. They're not taking care of their hygiene, which can cause issues not only for them but for staff members and other inmates.
Well, we've had two infestations of lice within the last year. And imagine going to work and you've got lice. We have typhus. I mean, we get those kind of crazy, just crazy things. You're right. I mean, we've had to quarantine. We had to close the unit and quarantine us for lice twice in the last year.
So walk me through it. How did the courts assess that this person is a danger to others? So we're going to put them in a prison where we don't, or put them in a place where they are taken off the streets because of their nature, but we're not going to treat them for that.
Well, they're two separate things. What happens is someone will get arrested, and they're sent to jail, and they get assigned a public defender, and the public defender quite rightly assesses them and says, this person's crazy. This person doesn't understand what's happening. They're psychotic. They need to be looked at. So they'll hire what's called an alienist, and that is really a court-appointed psychiatrist who specifically asks about competency or not guilty by reason of sanity. And just for competence, they'll write a letter and say to the court, this person's not competent to be tried. And that kind of stuff goes back to, like, Hammurabi Code. It's a bedrock of judicial systems, is you can't try or execute people who are psychotic and crazy. So the court says you're not guilty by reason of insanity or you're incompetent, and you go to Napa State Hospital and get treatment. Then a whole separate thing happens where they have a separate deal, and then they say, will you take your medicine? Oh, of course I will. Okay. And so then they rule you don't have to take it if you don't want. And that's a separate hearing after that thing is adjudicated, and they come to us with the right to refuse treatment. And a lot of them do. And the first thing they do when they get there is they say, I'm not doing it. And the court has said they don't have to. And why it's like that, I have not a clue.
Are they saying that it's against the civil rights of these people to be forced to take medication?
It is.
What about the civil rights of the people that they've assaulted?
We try and bring that point up, and I alluded to that in the book. I always am a victim's advocate, too. The victims are always forgotten. In other words, these people have killed people. Well, we have a lot of people who don't go to family events because they killed their family. And what about the victims? What about those people? I have a dedication in the book, you know, to my patients, but to their victims. They're always forgotten. What about their civil rights? What about the people who've been decapitated, murdered, and run over? They don't have a voice in all this, but the person who ran them over or decapitated them or killed them, they certainly have a big voice, and they have a lot of rights, and they have a lot of protections. And I'm not against patients' rights. I'm just saying this particular situation makes not a lot of sense to me.
Is this America's way of sweeping the dirt under the carpet and just hoping it'll go away? Are they hoping for Darwinism at its best, that they're going to put these sickos, these twisted people, these murderers, violent criminals in one place and just let them mete out their own justice? And
honestly, you may be right, and I hadn't really thought about it that way, but I know personally, I don't get much traction with this. I mean, when you put out a major book from a major publisher and you do major shows like yours, I'm not sure why the reaction isn't bigger. I don't know, but it just, and why, what the other side is thinking, I can't imagine being a judge and knowing this. Maybe they don't know, but now they do, and they still do it. I don't know what the attorneys are thinking. I don't know what the judges are thinking. They're all fine people. I got nothing against the legal system. I'm just not sure what the thinking is behind this.
Well, I think part of the problem is, and the reason it's not picking up traction, is what can little old me do, Doctor, that if the court's already making these stupid, ignorant decisions, what could I possibly do to help you? I mean, it's a fascinating story, and I'll sit back in mock horror and be blown away by it and read your book and share it with my friends, but what can I do?
Well, you can do stuff, and I'm going to make an analogy to same-sex marriage, gay marriage.
Well, let's talk about when we come back. We have to take a break now. When we come back, let's find out what we can do as citizens of this planet, knowing that this type of travesty is going on within the borders of our own country. We'll talk more with our guest, Dr. Steven Seeger, right after this.